You are listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Intern.cast show, where we, the hosts, much like the features that we review, have not yet graduated up to theatrical release. Yes, that's right, we review all things streaming. The highly suspect reviews, they are the Nintendo Switch, where we are still flipping the Switch trying to get our Ataris to work. As always, I am your host, Davey Peppers, and joining me is London. How are you today, London?
I'm good, and hello. Yay, it's just us today.
Yeah, it's just us. There's no TJ to bring us down. The coup begins now.
Well, as we were talking before, we think that he might have had control over Skype because we're having some issues. So.
Yeah, TJ is out right now, and he's remotely messing with Skype to make sure that we cannot get anything done without him, that we need him.
That's one way to maintain control.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta give him props. I have no idea how to hack Skype. It seems like a very difficult program to hijack.
Oh, yeah, I've already been having issues with that, too. I can't even change my bloody email address on here. I don't know how to access
All right, so how are you, London? What have you been watching? What have you been up to?
I've been good. Let's see. I've been doing quite a bit, just reading a lot, writing a lot,
yep.
Watched a couple things. I have finally updated my entertainment, and I got a Roku.
Nice. Hey!
Hey, yeah. Yeah, I'm with, like, majority of millennials. So, yeah, one of the things I did get was Sling TV, and I've been watching a lot of stuff through that, and I've been watching other things. But before I get into that, I will talk about something I did see that's pretty recent, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2.
What did you think? Because we talked about it a little bit on last week's episode, and we all, me and Aiden both loved it. So what did you think?
I am in the same boat. I wish I could be different just to be funny, but no, it is amazing. I was having such a fun time. The only thing I will say, and this is not a dog against the film,
right.
I did not have as big an emotional response as the first one, but that's because
really?
the first one, I was so surprised. Like, I did not expect it to be like, wow, this is funny, this is a great aspect of the universe. I would just throw, I mean, I didn't have low expectations, but I just didn't expect Marvel to take such a big leap and to be, you know, chancy in this. So I was like, wow, this is great. I really love this universe. And this time, I didn't see anything new, but did everything better. And I was like, so I was like, I had a much more enjoyable time. I would love to go see it again. I think it's a great summer film. I think anyone could go see it, and I think it'll be fun. But there is, and I do have something else to say about that, though.
Yeah.
I had a point when it reminded me of Avengers Age of Ultron.
Really?
No, this is something that, it's like I said, it's not necessarily bad, but this is what I thought of. When I watched Age of Ultron, it was like, there was a point in the movie, and I was like, oh my gosh, if I didn't have such a deep knowledge of comics, I don't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
And in Guardians of the Galaxy, there were references, I could tell the references, I did not know what they were for. I was like, oh, I get it now.
But the difference, I think, is that the references in Guardians 2 are just references. They're like little things where you're like, oh, those are cool. Like, they're Easter eggs for the fans. Where in Age of Ultron, I feel like a lot of that was stuff that was necessary to understand the plot.
See, that's the thing. I still think with Age of Ultron, I was still able to understand the plot, even without that. But I do agree with you with Guardians of the Galaxy. I think that you didn't need that. You know, you can still have an enjoyable time. It's kind of like Star Wars. Like, when you watch Star Wars, the original one, you don't know what the hell's going on. I mean, if you didn't see the other sequel, if Star Wars was just by itself, that was the only movie, and it didn't have, like, a trilogy, it wouldn't make any sense. It's like, okay, both the Death Star, now what? You know, or whatever. I felt the same with Guardians of the Galaxy, because, like, when they had, like, the other Ravagers, I was kind of confused with that. And then when I found out more about it, like, oh, I get it. And actually, it did actually improve for me. I was like, oh, that's interesting. They did throw the Easter egg in. I thought in the movie, I was like, I kind of like... See, the thing is, I think the difference really between the two, and I do will agree with you on this, is that the biggest flaw with Age of Ultron was the plot, but this one was, I had issues with certain character motivations.
Really?
But that's not really that big a deal, because it doesn't inherently weaken the story structure. So when I watched it, but when I watched, when I saw, like, the other information about the story, and I kind of got the references, I'm like, oh, I get it, and now I get the motivation, and I get it. Okay, that's fine. Okay, cool.
I get that.
And also,
anything else?
Yeah, that same day, I came home to watch Manchester by the Sea.
What did you think about that?
Okay. I think it's really, really good. I don't think it's great.
It's not great. It's like a critical
darling. And I feel like they spent a lot of time trying to... Here's the thing. I think that there's a couple of missteps in the movie. I think it's solid, but it tried too hard to be emotionally manipulating.
I do agree.
Yeah, and that's... I kind of didn't like, you know, they played the opera music. They had the slow motion. They would linger on scenes. It's like they're trying to make you cry. And I feel like... to me, people say the movie is depressing. I feel like it's just miserable. Because depressing is subtle. It's kind of like an ache. And to me, this movie was just kind of blunt. Like, I think a great movie that is depressing, that actually I cried during, was... it was Kurosawa's... I think it's called Kikyo.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it translates to live. It's one of his earliest films, and it's actually not even a samurai film.
Okay.
And it's about a man who's diagnosed with cancer, and he's trying... He's an older man, too.
Oh, yeah.
And so... That one is like, the story is just him trying to find purpose in his life, because he finds out that he really, everything was meaningless and everything worked towards was almost nothing. Yeah. And there's just a shot, and it's at the end, but it's also on the poster, so I'm not spoiling anything. It's him sitting on a swing set in the snow, and that moment is when everything just boiled up and I exploded. I bawled And the thing is, not only is that shot beautiful, but it has such deeper meaning within the story. And I feel like that is something that's depressing. I get. See, something like, and like I said, Manchester by the Sea, everyone's kind of touting it. But I'm like, it's kind of just, it's not really, like I said, it's just trying too hard. And I know that sounds kind of odd to say, but.
No, I get it. Of the, like, big Oscar movies, of the nominees from last year, it was probably one of my least favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I could see that. And I guess the thing is, it won a lot of awards. And I think Casey Affleck is a fine actor, but, I mean, he just does this the whole time, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I'm all sad and everything. I mean, the thing is, if you see his other films, he does the same thing.
Well, like, you have a few things that kind of go against it. Like, I would want to point out, like, Ain't Them Body Saints or Gone Baby Gone, but for the most part, he is pretty similar for the most part.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not saying, I'm not taking away, he's not, I mean, I think he's a good actor, I'm just saying that role, I don't feel like he stretched out as far. I mean, like I said, with the other ones, at least he was, you know, he's a little more thuggish. You know, he did something different. But this one, I feel like it's that same kind of... But, you know, whatever. So, let's see. What else I've done? Like I said, I did some reading. I'm still reading the Patrick Melrose novels. I've read the first two. Never Mind. Nice. And Bad News. Like I said, the first, they're all stories of, like, Patrick Melrose growing up through wealth. And the first one, he's six. He's kind of like, the story's about him kind of being abused as a child. The second one is called Bad News. Patrick Melrose, he's about 20. He's 22. He's a drug addict, and he's kind of dealing with that. And the book I'm on now is called Some Hope, and he's about 30, and now he's kind of dealing with, you know, the aftermath of his drug-addled years, and he's trying to, you know, kind of transition to being an adult and whatnot. So, like I said, it's an interesting story. You know, it has a deeper and more specific version of, like, The Great Gatsby, you know. It felt like you really connect and understand wealth in these characters.
Okay.
Something else, and this is my final thing I'm going to say. I did read another article from The New Yorker. I read another story.
Okay.
It's called Fly Already. And this one I actually enjoyed. I know every time I talk about that story from my previous podcast, I never liked them, but... And the reason why, I finally kind of have a reason, and it's that I don't... to me, a lot of the New Yorker stories are substance over style.
Okay. Like,
they talk about misery and resulting in nothing, and they have great ideas, great themes. It's just that the way it's conveyed and delivered doesn't really invoke any type of response from me. It just seems like it's kind of bland. But this story, Fly Already, it's about a... It's written by Edgar Carret.
Okay.
And anyways. And so it's about a man and his child. He witnesses a jumper, or someone about to leap off a building, and he's trying to talk down the jumper, trying to, you know, let him be safe. And his son thinks the jumper is a superhero. He's about to jump off and fly.
I can't help but think when you're like, he's trying to talk down the jumper, I can just see Hayden Christensen be like, I gotta jump. And then go from the first person in 10 years to ever reference jumper.
Oh, you know, I forgot he was in that.
Never forget Hayden Christensen.
One of Kristen Stewart's first roles, too. But she was nobody.
Really? She was in Jumper?
Yeah, she was at the very... spoilers. She was at the very...
No one gives a shit about Jumper.
Or that one guy. He's like, oh, that's right. I wanted to see that X-Men knockoff. Yeah. The guy that has Nightcrawler's powers and that's it?
Yeah. Yeah, I want to see... Yeah, just a bunch of those guys?
Yeah. No, but yeah, seriously. Actually, I think it was... Yeah, it was her. It was like a cameo because she was like at the end and she was like his sister... Like, when he finally meets his mother, who turned out to be, I forgot what they called him, what was Sandy Jackson's thing, the people that were after, the Paladins.
How do you remember this much about Jumper?
I don't know. I didn't even see it. My mom liked it, and I saw a little bit of it. I'm like, this is stupid. I just remember... Oh, you know why I remember? Because, Spill did a review of it. That's why.
Anyway,
that was funny.
Wow.
Okay, but yeah, whatever. That was, so, anyways, back to the New Yorker story. It's fun. You know, it's dark. Has dark comedy. It has a good, like I said, has an interesting theme, and it has, and like I said, it's also funny, and it's quite short too. So I think anyone will enjoy it. So
awesome. Yeah, and I've seen a couple things that I want to talk about real quick. I don't know if you've listened to the most recent Digital Noise, but they talked about this movie called Catfight.
Oh, I wanted to see that.
It's weird as hell.
Oh, okay.
It's super... It's weirdly structured, weirdly acted. It's got weird themes. And I think I really liked it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Because I was thinking... Yeah. So, good. That means it came out on DVD then. So I guess
it just came out on DVD. And I do recommend... I really recommend people check it out because it's not going to be for everyone, but it's so interesting and it's so different than what you expect. Even from like them talking about how it is a lot about like people profiteering off war, which is not what I expected from like the poster or the advertisements. It's got a lot of strange themes to it and a lot of strange themes about art and about women coexisting. And it's really fascinating. And specifically because of what we're going to talk about later this episode, it's definitely something worth noting.
Well, you know, they made a killer trailer.
Like,
really, I thought that trailer was awesome, and I was already sold from there. So I'm glad to hear that that's especially had all those themes. I didn't expect that. Yeah. I just thought it was going to be exactly what the trailer laid out. But okay, no.
Yeah, no, and I have no idea if you're going to love it or hate it, but it's. It's definitely worth a watch. I also watched Their Finest, which is this really emotional, really entertaining British movie about the like British film ministry in World War II making a film about the Dunkirk invasion so that they can basically tell America to get off their asses and start helping.
Oh, okay.
And it's a really charming movie that, as it goes along, starts to become this really emotional exploration of why we make movies and why we watch movies in the first place.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's not perfect, but it's really charmingly acted, and Gemma Arterton's the lead, and I cannot believe that I'm saying this, but Gemma Arterton's becoming one of my favorite young actresses working right now.
I love Gemma Arterton. I feel like she's... I mean... I keep... The first thought that comes to my head is freaking...
Hansel and Gretel.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember seeing her in that. I was like, oh, this actress is terrible. And then the voices, Girl with All the Gifts, and Their Finest comes out, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah, I feel so bad. It's like, that's what people probably know her from.
Yeah, she's got a little bit of the Kristen Stewart syndrome, where, like, she's really talented, she just had a really rough beginning.
You know what, I think that's a great analogy, because I feel the same way with Kristen Stewart. I'm like, you know what? You have talent. You just got dealt a bad hand.
Yeah, you got dealt a bad hand to start off, and you're trying to crawl out of that hole as best as you can.
I feel that way too with Robert Pattinson, funny enough.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's doing all those really weird, really good Cronenberg movies now.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. I mean, I know people, they made fun of Cosmopolis, but I actually thought he was good in it.
I really like Cosmopolis.
Oh, you liked it?
I like Cosmopolis, and I like Maps to the Stars, so...
I haven't seen Maps to the Stars, but...
It's weird as hell.
Okay, I might check it out.
Definitely check it out.
Tastes are similar. I didn't think I'd ever hear someone else like Cosmopolis, because I liked it too, but...
Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. Like, it's not perfect, but it's an entertaining movie, and everyone just shat on it.
I know, it's so funny. It's like, that limousine was so... I was just having fun watching that limousine, like, all the special gadgets and stuff.
It's just a good, weird time.
Yeah, yeah. Derailed that.
Yeah. And there's one more thing that I want to talk about real quick. And it's not a recent movie, but I did see it. And it's another one that I think is kind of thematically relevant to what we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. And it's a Denis Villeneuve film from 2009 called Polytechnique. It's like 80 minutes long. It's in black and white. And it's a dramatization of the Polytechnique massacre from the mid to late 90s, where this guy just gets a bunch of guns together and he's like, you know what I hate more than anything? Feminists. And he walks into his college and murders 14 women.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And disturbing. He walks into this, like, the big scene where, like, kind of all the characters kind of collide in the middle of the film is this engineering classroom. And he walks into the engineering classroom and says, split up, women on one side, men on the other. He makes the men leave. And he looks at all the women and he says, you're here because you are feminists. You are trying to be engineers and trying to do what men do. And then he shoots them. And it's this haunting... It's not perfect, but it's a very powerful exploration of misogyny. And how violent that can get. And I do think it's worth a watch.
Okay, well, that is perfect. That's perfect for what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. All right, so on that note, should we just go ahead and get into it?
Yeah, sure.
All right, what we are talking about today is the first, and maybe only, I don't know, first season of Amazon Prime's new show, co-created by Jill Soloway, called I Love Dick. London, do you want to tell us what I Love Dick is about?
Yay, one of my patented terrible summaries. Okay. So I Love Dick is based off of a novel by, it's kind of like a weird memoir / fiction experimental novel by a woman named Chris Klaus, who's also the title character.
Yeah.
And the show is about her and her husband, named Sylvier, who's a Holocaust scholar, I believe.
Something like that.
Yeah, and they go to this little Texan town called Malfa. Malfa. And while there, he's there on residency because he's supposed to help he's an artist, but he's like an artist and art critic too, I guess.
Yeah, like this famous, like, weird experimental artist person.
Yeah, he's supposed to be there to help him with some project, which we never find out what it is. And so while she's there, she becomes completely enamored by him. And the guy's name is Dick, played by Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. And Chris is played by Catherine Hahn.
Oh, yes, sorry. Yeah. And so the story is kind of like her... She starts... Well, at first, like, she's enamored by him. She's drawn to him, but he kind of keeps rebuffing her. And so she... Then she begins to write a bunch of Dear Dick letters.
Yeah.
And the story's kind of like the... It's almost like... it's also taking place from different perspectives because... Not only is that's like her story, but there's other characters, and they're all kind of like, they're all somehow involved with Dick, or they're involved with these letters, and it's all kind of meshing together, and blah, 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 and it's artsy, fartsy, yada, yada, so I'll let you take over now.
Yeah, and it's this weird thing where it's combining the lives of these women and their relationship with this man, Dick, and also art and what it means to be an artist and using other people for your art, and it's kind of meshing these, or kind of just shoving these two things together, kind of hoping that it sticks. And yeah, it all kind of starts when she and her husband use these letters, these Dear Dick letters, which, ironically enough, was exactly how I dealt with my puberty, by writing Dear Dick letters.
I have never heard of this strategy, or this methodology. Is this...
It didn't work.
Sorry to hear that.
And so these letters, they use them to basically kind of spice up their sex life, and they get out to the community. And everyone's like, this is something that we have to deal with. And it's, a lot of it's Catherine Hahn as Chris kind of going back and forth, be like, am I attracted to this guy, or am I repulsed by this guy? Because he's this very, like, macho, tough guy kind of person. And yeah, she's this feminist filmmaker. And not a lot happens over the 8 episodes, but it's just kind of the interactions between these people and how those things change.
Yeah, that's, like I said, that's honestly, it's, watching this, I felt like it could have, like, I don't know if how much I can, I don't know when to start criticism, yeah, but the one thing I'll say is it does linger a lot.
It, especially in the first half, it's, and the show takes a lot of references from, like, female experimental filmmakers. In every episode, there's, like, some clip from some experimental film made by a female filmmaker, and you can really tell that experimental film was a big inspiration, because sometimes just nothing will happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that was actually, I'm glad that you mentioned it, because I didn't look into it, but I figured that they, all the films, that the little short vignettes that they would interject into the stories, I figured they were, like, by women or female, yeah, female directors. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and two, not only that, there are just a lot of scenes where it's beautifully shot. I will say that.
Really?
The directors, I do. I think so. I think that there's a lot of scenes where it's just like the cinematography, because it's the area, just the landscape and the background and the, you know, the hills and all that. But the problem is, I see the shot. Beautiful shot.
Yeah.
Too long.
Yeah.
No point.
And
that's what, yeah, that's what I was going to get at.
I don't know. Real quick, I do kind of want to disagree with you about that, because, like, while I think it is really well directed, you have directors like Jill Soloway and like Andrea Arnold coming in and doing obviously a very good job directing these actors and kind of directing the story. I thought that the cinematography, for the most part, was kind of ugly, because it's very clear that Soloway took a lot of influence from people like the Duplesses, because Jay Duplass is on Soloway's other show, Transparent. And I mean, I recently drove across the country like 2 months ago, and we went through a little bit of Texas, and it's gorgeous. And this show made me feel an iota of the beauty that I felt just being there. And I know that cameras can never capture real life and all that stuff when it comes like natural landscapes and all, but I should still feel a little bit of awe when I'm in this place, and I felt none of that in the cinematography.
See, that's interesting, because I guess maybe because I never, you know, seen Texas or too much, yeah, or seen too many about it, or seen too many, yeah, films. Well, I've never really witnessed too much of it, but yeah, I don't know, I just thought there were certain shots, like there's a moment and where Catherine Hahn gets into like a jacuzzi or whatever the hell they call it.
Yeah, that's a good shot.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Yeah. I thought there were just certain, I'm not saying like overall, I'm saying that there's certain moments where I'm like, okay, I think that's actually quite, like, that's a good moment. And I feel like that's the thing. It's like, it's an artistic, you know, it's like that.
Yeah.
Do we really need that? I don't know. You know, it's like, but it's just like, hey, it's pointing there. It's just a beautiful shot. It's great. You know, it's like a picturesque, yeah, and, you know, and like, okay, I see it. But I mean, yeah, I'm sorry. What?
No, I was just saying, I agree.
You know, I think, like, oh, because the thing is, this town itself, it's dirty, it's small, it's,
yeah,
it's a very generic kind of Texan town, and it kind of makes sense that for it to be there, since this guy, Dick, he's like a big name there, and everyone knows him, everyone knows each other, you know, everyone, yeah, is like, it's like a small, it's gossips everywhere, so it's gritty, it's dirty, and it's just like, it's kind of like it's almost like, and it's like a, I guess I could say cesspool. It's just kind
of, it's
like
a little bit of a cesspool.
Yeah, like male, it's a cesspool of like male ego, you know?
Yeah,
like a lot 100%. Of it is like, yeah, so, that's what I'm saying, I think, but whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. But going back to, I think, something you were kind of alluding to, I really dug the performances.
I completely agree.
I thought that Catherine Hahn is great.
Yeah.
I think Sylvier, he's a lot more subtle, but he's, I'm not sure the actor's name. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm not sure, but I think he plays it really subtly, really well. And I'm glad, man, Kevin Bacon, he just, I mean, I feel like he's kind of typecast because he's playing an asshole, but
he's a little typecast, but he's so good in this, and he has so much more opportunity to kind of bring layers to this asshole character, because when things start to happen in the show and his ego kind of gets bruised a little bit, he's bringing so much subtlety and so much kind of hilarious pain and shame into the character that I thought he did a magnificent job.
No, yeah, I agree, because I thought in the beginning, like, he did a really good job, because I hated him.
Yeah.
Because he represented everything that's annoying about high art. Those guys.
I hated him through the end. Yeah, I think he's supposed to a little bit.
No, I honestly think this whole cast is full of unlikable and unrelatable characters, but, you know,
But I will say, I feel like every character, aside from him, had something to kind of redeem their unlikability. And I want to go on a little tangent for a second. The reason that Catherine Hahn's character stays in Texas is because she was going to go to Texas for like a day or two and then go to the Venice Film Festival, where she had a movie that was going to be accepted there. But she used a piece of music from a band without their permission, without paying them. And they sent a cease and desist letter to the, like, to the festival. And I don't know, and this is obviously just the filmmaker in me talking, I have no fucking sympathy for her for being sad that she got called out for not going through the copyright system, for using someone else's music without permission. I have no sympathy for her whatsoever for that.
Yeah, no, I honestly thought that, I mean, it, that's what Leah kind of made me laugh, is because, like, Kevin Bacon, a dick, he calls her out on.
Well, shit. So my recorder went out halfway through this review because my SD card filled up faster than it was supposed to, and because I'm pretty sure the technology is trying to conspire against us to not have any good episodes that don't have TJ on. So, London is back, and we are going to continue with our review of Amazon Prime's I Love Dick pickup, where we left off. London. Where we left off was talking about Chris Klaus, which still sounds like Chris Cross to me, and about how her not paying for the music rights for her film made me have zero sympathy for her. So let's go on from there. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm back.
Yay.
It's been so long. I totally forgot what we were talking about. Yes, let's see how this works.
Let's do this.
Yeah, but back to that. I think that just kind of was off the bat just a way to just show that, hey, we're dealing with unlikable characters. Because, like, I mean, I remember you talked about, but that the first episode was terrible. That's a pilot.
Yeah.
And it's just like, in the first episode, yeah, we have that where she didn't pay for her music. I mean, and the thing is, and Kevin Bacon basically calls Ron on it, and he's like,
yeah,
I mean, it's true. I mean, he does in a dickish way, but... dickish.
I mean, I would do it, too, in a dickish way.
Yeah.
It's honestly a shitty thing for a person to do, and I don't care about the character for so long in the show because of this decision, and because of her reaction to the decision, feeling like she's being attacked because they're pulling out copyright law on her.
I think it's just a way to just show that everyone is unlikable. Because honestly, there are no likable, and I'm trying to think, I don't think there's any relatable characters. Well, to me, Relatability and likability, I'm one of those people where I don't believe that needs to be inherently within any type of story, as long as it's a good story and the characters are organic. But, because I think those are two subjective terms. Someone might be likable to you, someone might be likable to someone else. But anyways, this one, I just kind of shows, is like, hey, these are flawed people, and, you know, they don't know, and she's not, and two, I think her arc is that she's kind of a crappy filmmaker. I mean, that's just plain and simple. I mean, from the beginning, I mean, even like a couple episodes in, I can't remember, she talks about how, like, you know, she wants to show her movie to Dick, and he's like, oh, you know, she was just starting to, you know, compare it to other works and what inspired her and everything. Like, listen,
play the movie.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's like, you know, that's that pretentious BS that, you know, people have. Like, they want to make it arty. They want to be recognized. Like, oh, this is like this. It's like they're prepping the critic. It's like, don't prep the critic. Just let the critic watch it.
Yeah, and if they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. I mean,
yeah.
To be fair, I've done the exact same thing. But I'm a 19-year-old, and she's a grown woman with, like, experience in life, and she should be past this phase. And that's a thing that I always get kind of annoyed with when, like, adult characters do stuff that I've done. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm so much younger than you, and I'm getting out of this phase, and you still haven't.
See, you know what's odd? It's like, that's something where I think it's just a weird note with the characters. It's like, at some points, they handle, like, difficult situations in a fairly mature way. Like, I'm being serious, like, because usually something happens, there's, like, this big fight, but no, to me, like, they did have some fights, but it wasn't as, like, Hollywood cartoonish. Like, to me, it seemed like, okay, this is, like, how fights with people, adults would act. But in other instances, they would have situations where it's, like, you are children.
Yeah.
It's, like, act mature. Like, come on. Your professors and, I mean, I guess it's like a satirical look at, like, hey, artists and scholars are dumbass kids too.
Yeah.
So I know, maybe it's a satire, but it wasn't, you know, whatever.
I mean, it obviously is a satire of, like, artistry and these pretentious people and stuff like that. And these characters work and they're interesting as a satirical exercise. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't fit the narrative. It doesn't work for the kind of story that it's trying to tell. Why would these characters be so stupid in a story? And the show doesn't set up any rules or any reasons for them to be this childish in their decision-making. I will disagree with you that there are... Not necessarily that there are no relatable characters, because there aren't any characters that really, like, spoke to me personally. But I think for the most part, especially as the show progresses, there are characters where you understand where they're coming from and you can relate to them empathetically, especially many of the smaller characters in the series.
I don't know. I had no connection with anyone. It was like, they were all just... I don't know. Like I said, I'm not the target audience, so I can't say that I relate to
them. Neither of us are.
Yeah. That's true. But yeah. I don't know. Like I said, it's just... Like I said, relatability is completely subjective, so it could be relatable with someone else that I just didn't, because, like, everyone, I feel like they all kind of did, they all were just, I know everyone I knew was unlikable, just unrelatable, but still, I didn't have that either, so, yeah, I guess that's where we have to disagree.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying, like, oh, I saw myself in this character, I'm just saying, I could kind of see where a few of these characters were coming from, and I did kind of feel a connection to them, even if I... Still, I am upset that I didn't feel that much of a connection to the primary characters.
I will say that I think the most normalized characters are the side characters. Because all the main characters are cartoons. Like, I have to say, yeah, I will say that. They're kind of like, I was going to say cartoons, because cartoons make them seem flat. They're extreme. All of the main ones are extreme. Like, these are people that would annoy me in real life.
Yeah, they're people that exist as exercises for satire and intellectualism and don't exist as story. And those side characters are more real. And bringing back to something that we agree on, the fifth episode of this show is brilliant.
Oh, yes, yes. I completely agree. You know what? That in, now there is, they're actually, now I'm thinking about it, they're the art, the museum, the gallery curator.
Yeah.
I relate to her the most. Actually, I take that, I have to backtrack a little bit. she, I felt like, seemed the most real. Like, I don't know, her character just seemed honest. So
I agree.
That one, oh, okay. Oh, okay, I'll hand you that one. That one makes sense.
Yes. Point one for me. But no, like, and I want to specifically talk a little bit about that episode, because it's an experimental style episode where four women basically tell the story of how they got to where they are and their relation to this guy, Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only, like, 25% about Catherine Hahn, which makes it the best episode of the series, because it's really intelligently done and really wildly put together, but also Catherine Hahn isn't in it enough for me to dislike her character, although she is wonderful in the show.
Oh, yeah. I think everyone's performance was great. Like, I can't... Yeah, yeah, I think, honestly, I think everyone's... I mean, she was... The only thing is with her, it was like... I don't know if we talked about this before, but, like, see, Catherine Hahn is extremely funny.
Yeah.
She is... She has excellent timing. I mean, she's done... She's done even, like, her little, like, her small works. Like, even in something as silly as, like, Step Brothers. I thought she, like, shot in that. Like, she had, like, such a stupid role, but I thought it was funny.
Did you ever see Bad Words, the Jason Bateman movie?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Okay, I really like that movie, and she's hysterical in it. There's a there's a sex scene between Jason Bateman and her and Catherine Hahn, and the entire time she's just yelling at him to not look at her, and then look at her, and then not look at her again. And it's so funny. She's such a funny, energetic character actor, and I do love watching her work. And I think this show's really proven that she can do something more real in tone, even if the character isn't all that real. And, of course, she's great on Soloway's other show, Transparent.
See, I think she's... Oh, I didn't know she was on there. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, she's a supporting role in Transparent.
Oh, okay. Well, like I said, she's brilliant. And two, honestly, now thinking it back, a lot of her funniest stuff is something sexual. Like, she's really good at sexual humor. And it's, yeah. I think in this, I mean, it shows that, like, it's kind of like weird. She's, like, playing a character that's, like, the extreme of the weird, neurotic, sexual character that she's played in the past. Except in a real or darker way. Like, yeah, what if this person was in real life?
Yeah, it's not a sexual, like, oh, sex, isn't that so weird? Like an Amy Schumer type most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
It's more grounded, but also less grounded. It's a very confusing, conflicting character dynamic to talk about.
Well, the thing is, it's like, I mean, we're joking about this off the recording, but, like, it's like a realistic 50 Shades of Grey. You know, it's like, the sex scenes, they're depicted in, like, these are very kinky, very, like, they're not the normal sex scenes that people show in, like, other programs. This is like, it shows all of the awkwardness, all of the kind of like odd ways that people have sex, and like the weird mental gymnastics that goes into it. And and I think that, you know, Catherine Hahn, she really just portrays that perfectly. I mean, I think she just, it fits. It's like it's all the weird awkwardness. She just, it just exudes into the screen, and like, all that kind of like, It's a little bit funny, but not really. It's like funny and like disturbing. It's like it's just awkward. Like you don't want to be in that room.
It is disturbing in a weird way, and I think one of the strengths of the show is kind of reflecting that back into us and saying, why is this disturbing? And we have to go, oh, because it's weird. And the show's going, well, why is it weird? It's people having sex. It's just a little different. And you do have to kind of reevaluate things, and kind of going back to the main point of this show, at least for me, is that it works really well as an intellectual feminist exercise, but it doesn't work as a narrative. It doesn't work as a story. If it wasn't, like, this should not be on Amazon Prime. This should be studied in, like, liberal arts colleges where people sit around it going, so what's the meaning of this use of this experimental film crap crossing with the dynamics of sexuality? Like, it needs that. It needs kind of this hoity-toity artistic view of it, the same thing that it's trying to satirize, because it's just not a show that's going to connect with people. It's not going to connect with people. It will connect with academics and people that call themselves academics specifically, but it's not going to connect with the ordinary person at all, I don't think.
Academics and people who, like, weird artsy stuff. Like, you know, yeah. Like those film buffs or film stops that don't might like it. You know, it's,
yeah.
Because all the weird, obscure film little vignettes that they have in each episode, they'll get off on, like, oh, hey, I know what that is. Oh.
Yeah, the show jumps to an experimental film made by a woman at some points, and sometimes it works and it makes sense, and you're like, oh, that's how that connects thematically to the episode. And sometimes it does not at all. Do you remember I think it's the third episode, it opens with this really uncomfortable piece of a woman, like, drinking out of the side of a milk jug and then spouting it out on the wall and then just repeating that for like a minute and a half.
Oh my god, yeah. You know, that's when you said the weird ones, that's the first one that jumped in my head.
Yeah, what the fuck was that about? Do you have any idea what that was?
I'm trying to remember what that episode was about, because I think watching it, I got it, but I don't even remember what my thought of. It's just, I felt like it's just people kind of, I mean, there's a couple things you can take out of that. The fact, you know, the regurgitation of, you know, art, you know, people kind of take the same thing and they spit it back out. You know, they take some, take a part of the world and they spit it back in, and then they kind of regurgitate the same type of themes. Like, I don't know if that was the episode where she was showing her, I think, was it the second episode she showed her movie?
I know that was the third episode, but I couldn't tell because the first four episodes just kind of merged together into this uncomfortable blob of, why am I watching this?
No, honestly, it did. Like, because that's like what like I said, that's what I got out of it. Like, you know, the fact that she was referencing the other movies while she was talking, describing her film. Or even it could be like when one of the other characters starts, like, she gets a hold of one of her her letters, and then they start to, they try to make a play out of it. The fact that people always take other people's ideas and they spit it back out and they spit it back out again. And that's it. Like, listen, everyone, I want y'all to know I'm talking out my ass. Okay. It's like, I don't know.
Mean, that's honestly, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that actually makes that episode in that moment actually make a lot more sense to me and is a more narratively coherent thing.
Yeah. Maybe I'm right. Maybe some commenter would be like, actually, this is a part of the realist movement. This is a reflection of it.
I would love if that would happen. If this podcast gets to a point where people can narcissistically explain to us things that we should have learned in college, like, that would be the fucking best.
I would have fun with that. Just to have, like, the debate. I was like, hey, man, that's great. I'm glad you knew that. Because yeah, I sure as heck did. I wasn't going to do research into it.
Yeah, congratulations, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I did enough research looking up the background of this book and the character and how weird it all is.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit more, because I know you did a little bit more research on it than I did.
Yeah, it's, the thing is, because, like, it, like, the story, it separates from, like, the one in the show, because, like, I think the original story took place in California. I think they had, like, the character, the guy, the original person that I think she based off of, I can't remember, it's Dick something, Dick Birkin or Durkin or something, or it was weird. And I think he's a British, he's not an artist, the original guy. He's like he's a critic. He's like a pop culture art critic or something.
Yeah.
And so she kind of based it off of him, and he got ticked off. I think he even got his lawyer.
I would be too. I mean, the character of Dick is not a likable person, and the whole, I'm assuming that the crux of the book is similar to the crux of the show, which is basically just watching this person's kind of macho masculinity just be slowly stripped away as people kind of gain their independence without him.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't read the book, but I looked up, and I think it's more about the letters. Like, I don't think it's about, I don't even know if there's, like, other characters besides, like, her husband, Sylvier. And it's just, so I think, like, the other stuff, like, the other characters in the show, I think they're, like, kind of, like, a reflection. Because this book has become popular now. Like, when it first came out, no one really knew about it, and, like, it kind of was, in a kind of cult status, but
yeah.
Now everyone is into it. So I think, you know, the show is kind of like, they incorporate that, how everyone, all the fans now are reflecting upon the book itself. Because I think the book was just mostly about her letters and this guy, Dick, what's his name. So it's, like I said, and she kind of like, I don't know if they said she started this movement or she made it popular or whatever, but they call it like this, a mixture between memoir and fiction. And because she takes real life and she puts her name in there. She takes real people and, you know, and she just very, I don't know if she said his last name in the story, but she did refer to him as Dick. And, you know, and it's just, and a lot of people were kind of like, some people kind of got upset by it, you know, of course, like him. And other people are like, hey, this is cool and interesting. And she even jokes around like, hey, you better, you know, be nice to me. I'll put you in my story. I'm like, hey, that's kind of a jerk move.
that's kind of a shitty thing.
Yeah, but, and even then, like they said, the story has been touted as this big feminist movement because it shows a character that will be generally held in society in a male, from a quote, male lens as unlikable. Yeah. And kind of just puts her out there without any, just, you know, kind of like that girl's attitude. Just completely, like Lena Dunham girls, just completely out there, doesn't care that you're unlikable, doesn't try to appease anyone, just like, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, and that's how this character is really depicted as. That's why you said, we complained in the beginning how the way she just cares about herself, the way she does her work, she just like unabashedly like, yeah, this is my work, you know, people should deal with it, you know, this, whatever. And
yeah,
like I said, I think that's what kind of made the book popular, because even the director, Jill Soloway. Yeah, she talked about, like, because she did an interview and she said that, you know, male men are going to be like, you know, this is stupid and X, Y, and Z, you know, she's crazy, why would you want to deal with her, and yada, yada. And then, you know, women are going to tout her as a hero. You know, that's a little bit of a blanket statement. I mean,
yeah,
you know, like I said, it's, I mean, some, that you can't judge. I mean, like you said, like, I'm pretty sure in academic circles, in academic and art circles, are going to like it, and just people without it are not going to like it. I described the show to a female associate of mine, she was like, this sounds awful, I do not want to see this in my life. I'm like, yeah.
And I think another thing, as far as all, like, men are going to hate the show, women are going to like it, and especially regarding the character of Chris, is it Chris Klaus? Because I keep hearing Chris Cross in my head.
I think that's a German phrase for Klaus.
The character of Chris is so unabashed, but it's in the name of this, in the name of this movement. It's like, oh, I'm being unabashed for the sake of finding true equality and being a woman, and that's awesome. But there's no, it's detached from the world, mm-hmm. in a way. It feels like the character is being out there specifically to be out there and to prove a point, and it's disregarding other people, not out of disregard, but out of this movement. And it doesn't connect this radical feminist ideology with the actual world. And I think the show might be trying to say that the answer is somewhere in between those two things, which I would hope. But I don't exactly know it, how to articulate what I'm trying to go for. I think there is a strong dissonance between the ideologies of people like Chris and how she treats other people than how, like, the world works. Because, again, you have a character like Hannah on Girls, who is obviously a very strong, very powerful feminist character, but still exists in the world and is still conscious of other people and how they would react to things.
Mm-hmm. I think that the show, I actually have to tie it up to, I'm not sure what direction it wants to take, because it's, you're right, it does put that forward, but there's also, like, it puts that, the ideological feminist movement, the concepts, you know, of art and how, like, how it's criticized, how it's looked at, and how, you know, are people judging it as true art, or are they judging it as what it should be expected it to be judged? Yeah. And, you know, because there's a lot of, and there's a lot of satirical commentary about that, because, like, they talk about, you know, I think it was the first episode where Chris makes fun of the fact that she can't sit through a lot of films directed by women, you know, like, it's a lot of, especially a lot of artsy films. I mean, you look at, like, Scorsese and you know,
Spielberg,
yeah. Yeah, and even some Francis Ford Coppola films, you know, those are, you know, movies you can sit through, like, they have artistic merit, and they're, you know, they can appeal to a larger audience, but she made the argument that, you know, lot of female directed films. It's not the case, which I'll agree. I like Lost in Translation, but
Hey, I like The Virgin Suicide, so
yeah. Edge of 17. Anyone out there? Edge of 17.
Fuck the Edge of 17. Oh my god, I hated that movie.
Oh what? Oh, you hated it?
I hated it so.
Oh my god, I'm so opposite. I fell in love with that movie. That's one of my favorite films.
Everyone else loved it. Like every single other person on the planet seemed to be like, this movie is amazing. It's funny. It's smart. And I'm like, I hate this. I hate her so much. The movie was not funny enough for me to forgive the fact that she was such a nasty person to everyone around her.
See, that's the thing. That's what I mean. I can watch something with a genuinely unlikable character. Like, I don't know, that's something that doesn't, like, bother me.
I can too, but specifically with Edge of 17, something about her character, Nadine was her name.
Yeah.
So something about Nadine was, and it's a very personal thing, it's, she represented the worst parts of myself if I hadn't have grown up. Just like this, like, self-effacing, like, oh, I have all these problems because everyone else is so mean to me, and basically blaming things like depression and anxiety issues on just other people being assholes, and, oh, that's why, because everyone hates me. And I'm like, no, shut the fuck up. Oh, I hated that movie, and I hated that character.
See, I had the same effect, but I like the fact that it kind of, like, to me, it showed, like, the bad side of me to my face, because I was like that. Like, in high school, I was a scoop. I had that same attitude, like, that angry, miserable, yeah. I like seeing that on screen, like, oh, okay, so, you know, this is how I am, and, you know, and this is, like, and it felt like, it was, like, me reflecting upon my past self, and, like, now I'm, like, well, I'm older now, and I understand a little bit better. I'm only 25, but, you know, a little bit more of how the world works, so.
And I mean, maybe with that movie, a lot of it is I'm not fully out of that yet, because I'm 19, so I'm literally just getting out of that high school stuff. But it felt like the movie didn't indict her the way that I wanted it to, which compared to something like I Love Dick, bringing it back around,
yeah.
I think the show does at points indict its characters. Again, yeah. I don't think it narratively is as sound as it wants to be. But I think as an exploration of this radical feminism and also kind of an indictment of this and saying, hey, these ideologies are good, but they don't really work in the real world. There is not a strong, like, this type of movement cannot function in the real world the way we want it to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best thing about the show is this indictment and this understanding of these ideologies.
Yeah, I agree with you. Because it's just, yeah. I mean, I think it's just tough to see, like, any type of, like, aside from maybe, like, if you're an actor, you can study performances, there's not really much else you can get out of, except for seeing these bigger, deeper ideological ideas. Or, like, you can kind of, like, if you are so invested in you yourself an artist, or you're really deep into, like, experimental, or, like, the contemporary art form that they have in the show, I think that you can, like, laugh at it just from, like, that perspective, because it reminded me a lot of, like I said, like, Maggie's Plan, because Maggie's Plan by, the Frances Ha woman, I can't remember her name.
Greta Gerwig's in it.
Yeah, Greta.
By Rebecca something.
I remember her. I just noticed she's an actress, and so in that movie, it was, a lot of it was making fun of, academia, the fact that, you know, there's a lot of these weird different departments, like cryptofictos, to not whatever, blah, 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 stuff that I studied in school. And it's just like, that's the joke. And, you know, if you're really deep into that scene or in academia, then you will laugh at it. You're like, oh, yeah, that's kind of funny. I don't think it projected that humor well. I don't think it was, the style was structured properly, but you would get it because you get the references. And in this scenario, in this show, it's the same thing. If you're really into it, you laugh at, like, oh, yeah, I get it because, you know, like, I don't want to spoil it, because towards the end, there's a lot more stuff that goes on that kind of, like, it really delves into that satirical element of, like, how a lot of it is just people kind of doing stuff so they can get accolades or get some attention, you know, it's about the artwork. They're not really doing it for just the art itself. If the only character that's actually doing something that's basically, based off of her own art is the main character, Chris Klaus, and that's after she gets she gets scored and she writes those letters. So, yeah. Dick.
Yeah. On that note, let's do our final thoughts, then we can maybe go into a little bit of spoilers, because yeah, sure. I know we've talked a lot about, like, the themes and what it all means, but I feel like we need to maybe talk a little bit about more the actual plot in spoilers if we can. Yeah.
I mean,
because nothing happens up until, like, episode 5 and onward.
Yeah, it's tough, yeah, because it's only 8 episodes, and 2, yeah. It doesn't start, stuff doesn't get interesting until the 5th episode.
So. Yeah, and that is the best episode, and yeah. I would highly recommend that people watch that episode. I think that episode is a lovely episode of television.
Yeah, honestly, you don't even need to watch the rest of it. You could just if you don't like if you're really in, I mean, well, we'll get into final thoughts, but fifth episode. Just if you could take that away, you can leave. Just say fifth episode. Watch.
Yeah, it's a fantastic short film, and you can understand. Just look up stuff on Wikipedia for like 3 minutes, and then watch the fifth episode, and. Mm-hmm. You'll be good. Okay, London, what are your final thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, like I said, it's filled with unlikable and unrelatable characters. I think, you know, in the story, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think as long as the characters work in an organic setting, it's fine. I don't think it does work here. I think narratively there are some issues, but overall, I thought aside from that, the performances were all solid. I think everyone did a great job in them. It's just that the characters were kind of rigged a little off.
Yeah.
It's another issue is the pacing.
Yeah.
This should have either been a movie, 90-minute film, or 4 episodes, 1 hour each. Because yeah. It's just 30. It's a 30-minute episode, 8 episodes, and it just seems like it just feels off. There's a lot of moments where the show just lingers. Cinematography that just lingers on things. I think there are certain beautiful cinematography moments, but it's very few and far between. You know, I think there's a couple, but in general, I think it could be short. And I think too, it's just so they can have those little experimental vignettes. But even then, you could have done it in a movie. So,
yeah.
I do like what the show is doing. I dig the fact that it has these intellectual and honestly, even some psychological elements too. I mean, it kind of explores characters and relationships. It has these really raw, unusual sex scenes, so I think that's interesting to put out there as well. So I'm gonna have to give it. Like I said, it's heavily flawed, but I do respect it. So I have to give it like a 7 out of 10 times. I wanted to brush Catherine Hahn's hair.
Not bad.
She took a shower and it was still. I just brush it once.
Yeah, I mean, these characters do look unflattering for the most part, and I think that's kind of the point, and I do like that. And there are a lot of things about the show that I do like intellectually, and as someone that likes to watch movies and television, and as someone who wants to make those one day, but my God, it just does not work as a story for the most part. It's stuck in between its experimentation and between the story it's trying to tell, and I don't think it does either of those perfectly well. I want to take this to college campuses and just throw it at them and be like, you're welcome, go write a 20-page paper on this, because you can. There's so much to talk about with this show, and so much to talk about connecting it to other shows that are prominent right now, like Handmaid's Tale, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and such. But it's not a compelling enough narrative. And I think that's the biggest problem with watching the show as entertainment, is that it's not that entertaining. It's smart, it's clever, it's very well thought out, it's just not that entertaining. And we've seen Soloway, they've made a wonderfully entertaining, smart show before with Transparent, which is incredible. And here, it feels like they're trying to take the parts of Transparent that make it so special. They're trying to push that to 11, and they're forgetting the parts that make it good.
Hmm.
I feel like this is a show that's... I Love Dick is a show that's trying to be special without being good first. And that's a big problem for me.
Okay, I think that's a good... Yeah, that's interesting, yeah. I can see that.
Thank you. Because it does work very well as an intellectual feminist exercise and an argument for and against this type of very radical feminism and seeing how that functions in the real world, but it just doesn't work.
You know, I don't mean to cut in your final thoughts, but
no, you're good.
I just, do you think that, like, because, you know, Jill Saw, like, with Transparent, Jill Soloway seemed to have more of a firmer hand on that show. This one had a lot of different directors.
Like, it felt more like a collaboration, but without a clear captain.
Yeah. Do you think that's kind of like, that played a part in it as well? Is the fact that she didn't have such a firm hand over it?
I think that definitely had a part in it, yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, I'll say continue. Yeah.
Okay. But no, it is very clearly a collaboration between Soloway and the real Chris, and then other directors like Andrea Arnold. These are all very talented people, and maybe they all should have just made their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, again, it's a lovely intellectual exercise, and I do recommend it for people that are into that type of thing. But if you're not, steer far, far away from this show. And if you want something that speaks to those feminist themes, but you don't want to watch this, just watch Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or The Handmaid's Tale, because those are both much better. So I would give I Love Dick season one. Is it the only... Is there going to be a season two? Can you think of any way that a second season could come out of this?
You know, honestly, the way it ended, I don't know what else they could do. Like, really, it just... And to me, ending it here, to me, would be the most respectful. Like,
and it would be easier for us.
Oh, yeah. It's like, okay. No, you're not bringing me back.
So, oh, I'm definitely... If they do a second season of this, you are coming back on, and we are dealing with this together.
Oh, like the Adam Sandler thing? Yeah. Right.
Okay, I'm not going to make you watch any more Adam Sandler movies if you don't want to, but I will make you watch more of this if it comes on.
God, that is a tough trade, but I will take it.
Yeah, I thought so. So I will give I Love Dick Season 1 5 out of 10 uncomfortable new Crayola colors. Do you know what I'm referencing?
No.
Okay, there's... In one of the earlier episodes, they're like, when they're doing the play that's based off the letters,
yeah,
they describe a color as cunt red.
Oh my god, I kind of forgot that.
That, I did not forget that at all. Oh, that has been stuck in my head ever since I watched it, and I just imagine like a big Crayola box with like maroon, periwinkle, cunt red, and you're like, oh. And just that image of like a little child picking up a Crayola box and picking out that crayon is hilarious to me.
See, your mind like took ways to like to create imaginative ways to like leave what you were watching.
Yeah, I was like, well, this isn't funny. So what? Let's think about traumatizing a child because that's more enjoyable and palatable to me.
See, I just my mind just like it negates itself. It's like when I watch Adam Sandler. After a while, it's like you don't want to see this. I'm just gonna give you a chat. I'm just gonna just turn you off for a little.
Amazing. Okay. So on that gross enough note, let's go into spoilers for I Love Dick season 1.
Yes, but I mean, like I said, honestly, it's the season 5. I'm sorry, season 5. Episode 5 is where things pick up, because it's just, like I said, it's what we say, it's like a short film, and from there it's we on top of that, it gives us background on all of like the all the main characters, well, except for Dick. No, we get a little background about Dick too.
It's basically background on the four primary female characters in the show.
Yeah, and they kind of, in their way, they do a background on Dick, because like they're in each of their little stories is about Dick, so we kind of see more of we understand more of where he comes from. So
right,
yeah, and like I said, from there it's just like it's kind of tough to talk about spoilers, because like I said, after that it's really like, because everything before then kind of, all those episodes, it just blurs into one episode.
Yeah, because it's not that interesting. But after episode 5, what happens after is much more... It's much more compelling because we have that backstory, and the show really starts to take shape as it reveals that it's about this deconstruction of this character, Dick, and as people reject him and move on without him. And we watch him just kind of fall apart.
Yeah.
which is really funny at points.
No, what did you describe his personality at first? It was
a mixture of shit. I remember it was Ernest Hemingway and somebody.
Like John, was it John Wayne or?
Yeah, it was a mixture of Ernest Hemingway and John Wayne.
That's what it was. That was so perfect. And you know, the funny thing is, it's perfect too in the fact that both of those figures, they were known to put on a face. Like that whole cowboy persona John Wayne had was a fake. Ernest Hemingway was a deeply depressed, lonely individual, and that whole tough guy bravado, you know. It was all BS, and he was really, because he had that deep. Ernest Hemingway. I mean, aside people can complain about his writing or blah blah blah. He was a true artist.
I love Ernest Hemingway.
Huh?
I love him. I love Ernest.
Yeah,
Hemingway.
See, I do too, and I do think he's a true artist. And he hung around with the artist crowd. You know, all according to what Midnight in Paris told me. So,
which is obviously a 100% factual account of time travel and artistry.
Yeah, I'm totally taking a trip to Paris. And so,
yeah, absolutely, me too. Gonna hang out with Ernest Hemingway and be like, so, maybe don't drink all of it.
Like, hey, you know, maybe put the guns away.
Yeah. Have you thought about archery? It's a lot harder to get that in your mouth. Jesus Christ, that got darker than I anticipated.
Well, hey, show. Oh, it fits well with the show we're talking about.
It does.
But
it does.
Well, there is no suicide in it. Hey, there you go. There's no suicide.
Oh, that's an improvement on 13 Reasons Why, so.
Okay, I listened to that, and I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah, that should be the closest you get to that show.
and to this one as well. So, yeah. but yeah, you know, the whole point back to, like, the deconstruction thing. He has that kind of, like, that fake bravado, and by the first episode, he really emanates it. Like, he's such a, I don't want to say dick, but yeah.
But he is, he's such a dick.
Yeah, it's like, damn it, I keep feeding into the wrong pun. It's like, damn it, I can't escape them. But, yeah, it's just, he's so that way, and then everyone just congratulates him, and like, all of his work is just, it's his masculinity. It's his, like, it's his male ego. Like, everything, like, every stone he makes, like he has, like, a stone, it's like, oh, that's a penis. It's like, it's obviously a penis going into a vagina. I mean, and there's a dick. I mean, not the dick. The brick that's, like, going up, and it's like, okay. Everything is just, you know what it also reminds me of? Have you heard of Mondrian?
I have no idea what that is.
Mondrian, he was... Okay, everyone, I'm going to get real art history nerd on y'all. In the during the early, like, 1900s, that was during the time of modernist art. Now, everyone knows what modernist art is. That's the most simple kind of... that's when art really got pretentious. Like, really, like, because before that was, like, impressionism. And this art is, like, it looks like wallpaper, really. Like, but people... There's a guy named Mondrian. He's like, oh, yes, this is... art in its simplest form, and you know, it was that period when people were like Jackson Pollock, you know, the splatter paint, like they have to describe what it meant instead of just looking at it. And to me, it's like that's what it reminded me of, because Dick, he had to like his work was like he had to like explain it, you know, it's just like you look at it and it's just like it sometimes looked like wallpaper, sometimes it was just a brick that he put up, and at one point the brick gets broken. And he just puts it together, and he names it. It's just like...
Yeah, it is ridiculous. And I don't mean to cut you off,
no,
but because we are doing spoilers, and our time is getting pretty close to up, because it's been over an hour of this show.
Oh, my God.
I do want to talk about one thing real quick.
Yeah.
And it's my favorite moment of this show.
Oh, yeah.
And it happens in the final moments, because... Chris and Dick finally start to get it on. They're both a little high, they're both a little drunk, and they're starting to kind of get really frisky with each other, and it gets this really graphic, dirty sexual talk. And Dick puts his hand in Chris's vagina, and they're talking to each other. He's like, oh, you're so wet. And she's like, oh, you make me so wet. And it's this, like, both tender but also very graphic moment of them both kind of realizing their sexual desire. And then Dick lifts his hand up, and it's covered in period blood.
Yeah.
And in that moment, all of his masculinity, all of his power, all of his ego is stripped like a snakeskin. It just falls off. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of silently goes to the bathroom and starts washing his hands with a 1,000-yard stare reminiscent of people that went through World War I. And watching this person go from that big to that small, because he thinks, he's like, oh, I'm such a sexual god that I've made this person mm-hmm. that sexually aroused. And it's not that. It's the natural course of her menstrual cycle, of her being a woman. Mm-hmm. And just seeing that power strip from him is the funniest goddamn thing in this show, and that I've seen in a while. Like, I have a lot of problems with the show narratively. It might all be worth it just because of how hard I laughed at that part.
You know, it's funny because I didn't actually laugh at that point because I was totally into the awkwardness of it, but I had so much respect for it because of, like, the symbolism yeah. of it all.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, and sexually it seemed like he was dominating.
Right.
And then that just, in a simple, just natural biology, all, you're right, everything just switches on a dime. And it's funny because then at that point she seems more mature. Like, she's like, oh, yeah. this is something that naturally happens. And just him, he's so just, that ego is just shredded. And he just, yeah. he can't, like, that, he it's like he can't even, like, that's something that just women do, and it's not a big deal. Yeah. But he just, he looks so, he becomes, and you're right, and Kevin Bacon, I gotta give him his brilliant performance, he looked like a child.
Yeah, he really did.
And like, this, you know, And you know, I thought it was great, and then that's the last part of the show, is that she yeah. takes his hat and she walks away. And yeah. it's like, she basically, yeah, she beat him.
Yeah, she won. Yeah, she won. She won this power struggle that's been going on throughout the latter half of the show, and it's a really empowering moment, and it's a powerful moment, mm-hmm. and also just something about the symbolism and what it all meant and how shocking it was. I think was just hysterical. And that's mostly what I wanted to talk about in spoilers, because I do like talking about that moment, because that moment alone opens up such a can of worms, both symbolically and also, it's just funny to talk about. It's just a funny moment watching this person be so emasculated so fast.
You can just watch, like, the first episode, which is terrible, but you get the gist of it.
The first episode's so bad.
I would say watch the first, if you really want to watch the show, if you just, yes. you're just curious, watch the first one, watch the fifth one, and then watch
the last one?
And then watch the last one, because you can see him be such a dick, and then have him lose all his masculinity.
Yeah, it's
because you don't really need to watch the rest of the episodes. Just watch that.
That's all you need. Like, it's like 90 minutes of your time, and that'll get you everything that you need from this show.
Yeah, honestly, you just crunch it down and done. So
yeah, and then you're good.
But yeah, I mean, aside from it, I think that was probably, I think the best, like, character. I mean, that was the best kind of character arc was Dix. Because everyone else, I kind of like, they had, their character arcs were okay. I just didn't buy how everything worked out for them. Like, the Devin, she convinces the town to be in a play. I'm like,
yeah, I don't know what the hell any of that was about.
I know, I'm just like, how do you convince these extremely masculine guys to be in this play? I mean, I know, like, you know, it's not a big deal of men being in a play, but this is like a very, this is like a,
it's very feminine.
Yeah, this is a very, like, Texan town. Like, this isn't like Austin. Yeah. this is a small Texas town, and like, these are guys who, they work on an oil rig and they go to a bar and drink.
Yeah.
And yet they're doing a play about, this is my inner beauty and I'm expressing it to you.
Yeah, a lot of it just didn't really connect, because, and honestly, I think Dick's arc works the best because his is the one that's mm-hmm. the most clear.
Yeah.
I still don't entirely know. I couldn't trace out Chris's arc for you. I couldn't really trace out anyone else's arc other than a few specific points, where Dick, I could diagram his arc through the entire show.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean to the point where he, like, the scene where he sees that woman, one of the professors, and she basically strips down and has her own little of performance art and in an oil rig and whatever. And she got like all these views, and he just gets
right.
And he throws, and that's the first inkling that I saw him being like a child, because it's like he's like he got. Like, she got more than me. And he's like, I don't want this gallery anymore. I'm done. And he gives it away. he just gives away the gallery.
He's such a petulant child once any bit of conflict comes into his life.
Yeah, right. And the thing is, the show, it's so much about Dick. I mean, like, really, and you're right. I think he has the most clear and honest-looking arc. And every arc and everyone else is, like, reflecting upon him. And it's, like, him kind of learning and just seeing that bravado and all the ego is gone, and it points to that quintessential moment at the end when, you know, that awkward scene. So yeah, I completely agree with you. I think he does have the most clear arc. I think he has the most honest motivations. I think his character is the most organic, because he seemed real to me. Or not say not the most organic. I take that back, because there's a couple of the side characters are. He's of the main cast, the most extreme people. I feel like his arc is the most organic.
Like, I completely agree.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's all I could say about it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Intern.cast, where we covered I Love Dick Season 1. As always, be sure to subscribe to the lovely oneofus.net, your one-stop shop for all things geek. London, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Oh, you can check me out on Twitter at @narrativeexam. I'm also working on a website of my own. That is going to be, I do freelance work, but I do have a blog as well, but my blog has a weird URL right now, so I'm working on that, so I'm making it a real site. So, yeah, check out for that there, and like I said, I'll announce it on my Twitter, at @narrativeexam. So, yeah, check it out. And like I said, that on my blog, I talk about films, I talk about novels, I talk about screenplays and articles. I do a little bit more scholarly stuff.
Awesome, and you can find me on Twitter at Davey Peppers. It's Davey, and then Peppers, like the food. And you can find both of our work at oneofus.net. As always, thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.